what I go to.
This is going cold.
Okay, let's get Rowan again. Any questions before I get? Now, where we left off is the idea of taking the problem situations one at a time as a way of getting a snapshot of what problems or why the person's having difficulties with anger. And Chris gives a good example of that. One thing to keep in mind is, you know, with depression, it's easy or relatively easy to identify thoughts and feelings because your average depressed person spends a lot of time sitting and thinking and paying attention to what they're thinking. When we got to anxiety disorders we talked about, there it's often harder to spot the thoughts because the anxious person often is focused on whatever they're afraid of. They're not focused on their thoughts and feelings. And the angry person is often focused on the other party's behavior and how badly they're being treated by the other person, and is often not paying attention to their own thoughts and feelings. So the first time you try to pinpoint thoughts in the session, the person may honestly have no idea what they were thinking while they sat there waiting for Charlie to show up, because they weren't paying attention to their thoughts and feelings. They were focused on, you know, Charlie, how inappropriate Charlie's behavior was. And so we may need to try several different situations before we succeed in identifying the thoughts and feelings, or may need to try it in a situation or two. The person draws a blank, they don't remember what was going on, and as homework we send them home to pay between now and the next appointment, paying attention while you're sitting there waiting for Charlie to show up and notice what you're experiencing. And that's real useful. One of the things I want to pay attention to is obviously, you know, the drawbacks of the current behavior we want to help the client register. But I also want to get their sense of what would happen if they didn't handle it this way. You know, and Carl's image is, if he lets people get away with this stuff, they'll just treat him worse and worse in the future. Okay, I need to file that away. That's something that we're going to need to address when we start looking at alternative ways he could handle these situations. Another good question that Chris asked, and it's easy to overlook, is that does a person have an image of how they'd like to be able to handle this situation? And for some angry clients, they have no image of how, they don't like what they're doing currently, but they have no image of alternatives. And so, in order for them to handle things differently, we're going to need to spot some alternatives. Other people have an image of how they'd like to be able to handle it, but they're not able to for one reason or another. So we're going to want to find out what stops them. Why don't they just go ahead and talk with Charlie calmly and reasonably if that's what they would like to do? And sometimes it turns out the reason they can't do it is they suppress their anger until they can't hold it in anymore, and this is not prime time for thinking clearly and making good choices. You know, for other people, there are other factors that get in the way. Often, it's the person's expectations about how the other party is going to respond. You know, they won't take me seriously. It won't do any good. So, cognitions. One thing that's interesting, I've had a number of male clients who are hesitant to be assertive, because the image they've got is, if I speak up for myself and it doesn't work, then I have to fight the guy. I'm not sure where they picked up that assumption, but that makes it a lot scarier to try speaking up for yourself. I'm also going to want to find out, are there times when the person is able to handle anger and conflict just fine? And there certainly are plenty of people who, now, they're terrible at handling anger, and they, you know, handle it badly in all contexts. There are also plenty of people who handle things fine in some contexts and not others. For example, I've worked with a lot of people where if they're angry with a coworker or a client, they handle it just fine. If they're angry with a spouse or kid, everything hits the fan. Because it seems to them that, well, at work, you've got to be nice to people. But at home, for the people you love, you don't have to be nice. Wait. Another thing to pay attention to is substance use part of the picture. Worked with a couple once upon a time who had big knockdown drag out fights. And it turned out the fights only happened when they were drinking. It happened every time they were drinking. Ah, we've got a substance abuse problem here, not and specifically an anger problem here. In terms of intervention, you know, we want to establish a collaborative relationship. And that's not hard if I'm working with somebody who comes in saying, "Doc, I've got a problem with anger, please help me." Then I just, "Yeah, sure," and we've got a collaborative relationship. But with anger problems, we're often dealing with somebody who's dragged in against their will by their employer or their spouse or their parent or their kids or the hospital system or... And when somebody's dragged into my office and they don't want to be here and they don't necessarily see it as a problem, then it's a lot more work to establish a collaborative relationship. Generally, a motivational interviewing kind of approach, where we start off by taking a look at in what way, you know, first of all, I want to be empathic and understanding. And my understanding is it's not their idea of being here. It sounds like they think this is a pretty dumb idea. You know, how do they see it? You know, as they see it, are there any ways in which their anger is a problem for them? You know, here Chris was tuning into how uncomfortable Carl was during that 20 minutes waiting for Charlie to show up. And that's highlighting one of the ways that he doesn't like the status quo. You know, she could have also emphasized a little more about how, over the years, his relationship with his coworkers has deteriorated, and he feels like he's not being treated the way he deserves to be treated, but somehow or other, he hasn't been successful, with his current strategies at getting treated the way he wants to be treated. Yeah. And, suppose we just decide things are the way they are and don't make any changes. Is this a situation that's going to gradually get better and better? Or is this a situation that's gradually been getting worse and worse over time? Suppose we could come up with some better ways to deal with anger and conflict. What advantages would that have for him? If the guy's concerned, if I don't stand up for myself, I'll get taken advantage of. Okay, well, suppose we could come up with some ways of handling anger and conflict where you're not getting taken advantage of. But you're not getting in trouble, you're not pissing off your coworkers, you're not putting in a block of time feeling real uncomfortable. How would that sound to you? And, I want it to be clear that it's not a matter of me trying to make Carl do stuff he doesn't want to do. It's a matter of us working together to accomplish things Carl wants to accomplish. That's going to be a lot more effective. One thing that's important on the collaboration front is thinking about goals for therapy. And I've had plenty of clients who come into therapy where I have some, my standard, imagine we work together for a while and we're wonderfully successful. How would you like things to be different when we're done? And, I've got a lot of clients saying, I have to control my temper. Do I want to just sign on to that? Well, if what they mean is hold things in as long as possible, no, this is not, a promising game plan. Now, I'm going to want to find out, well, what do you mean control your temper? What do you have in mind there? Gee, it sounds like you're talking about holding things in as long as possible, but weren't you just saying that that's a part of the problem? And I might want to propose a more promising alternative. How about if we work together to consider a range of options for dealing with anger and conflict and see if we can come up with some options that work in real life and that you're okay with and that your boss is okay with? How about if we see about coming up with some options that you can live with and your wife can live with and that work out well and result in a better relationship rather than a worse relationship? There are a lot of different interventions we can use in helping people with anger problems. And in the hopes of making things a little more manageable, I've tried to organize it in terms of what we're trying to accomplish. So on page 5, I've got my current attempt at organizing a bunch of possible interventions for the anger problems. Often, part of the problem is the intensity of the client's anger. And so it may well be that one of the things we want to do is tone down the intensity. How can we do that? Well, we've got a variety of options depending on exactly what's going on. And, you know, these aren't in any particular order. Sometimes part of the intensity is a person feels like, I have to put up with this, which tends to result in a more intense reaction. And, you know, looking at, is it that they have to put up with this, or is this a choice they're making? And sometimes it turns out, no, it makes sense to get the heck out of this situation. You know, I don't have to put up with being treated this way. I need to go find another job. I need to get out of this relationship. Now, often it turns out, I don't like the way I'm being treated, but leaving is not the way to go. Do I want to choose to put up with it, or do I want to see if we can come up with any ways to improve the situation? When the intensity of the client's reaction is part of the problem, my leading suspect is this person suppressing their anger as long as possible and then trying to deal with things when they can't take it anymore? And what's the better alternative in that situation? Well, gee, it seems like if they can come up with adaptive ways to handle their anger before they're at the explosion point, that sounds a lot more promising. One of the things I need to do is figure out how can I get this concept across to the client in a way that'll make sense to them. Because when we start working on this, often the person is really convinced that their anger is the problem and what they need to do is control their temper, by which they mean suppress their anger. And I can be empathic about how concerned they are about this, and it sounds like they really see it as a major problem. What do they think of holding their feelings in as much as possible? Now, how happy are they with that as a way of handling the situation? How well does that work out with them? And then maybe an analogy. You know, let's imagine we've got a river that floods from time to time and wipes out all the towns and villages downstream. This is not a good thing. Man, it sounds like we need to control the river. Not a bad concept. You know, if we call in the Army Corps of Engineers, they're going to want to build a dam. They love building dams. You know, are they going to build a big, strong dam that shuts off the river? Well, no, not only would the ecologists give them hell over that, but if I build a big, strong dam to shut off the river, the water keeps building up behind the dam. Sooner or later, there's going to be more water behind the dam than the dam can hold back. The dam washes out, we have a bigger flood that does more damage. This does not sound like a good solution. The Army Corps of Engineers may well build a dam, but they build a dam with a spillway in it, and they choose when to let the water out and when not to let the water out, and they try to time it so that there's never more water behind the dam than the dam can handle. And that sounds like a more promising solution. You know, that the problem with holding anger in as long as possible is then when I do try to do something with anger, I'm really upset. This is not prime time for thinking clearly. This is not prime time for making good choices about what to say and do. Suppose I could notice when I'm starting to get fed up and come up with some good options before I'm at the exploding point. What do they think of that as a concept? That generally makes sense to me. And I could even throw in, you know, if I'm pretty good at handling anger, I could wait till the feelings are pretty intense. But if I'm not very good at handling anger, I probably better deal with it before things build up too much. Now, then the question is, okay, so what options are there? What could I do if I'm starting to get fed up and I could take, you know, Junior's not doing his homework, or, you know, a mundane situation in their life? You know, what options are there? What could a person do in that situation? Often people react as though there are no options. They have no image of what one can do other than holding things in as long as possible and then go nuclear. And so how do we come up with some good alternatives? You know, one line of questioning which works pretty well is, do they have any friends or relatives who handle these sorts of situations pretty well? What do they do? You know, what have they seen in terms of, you know, figures on TV and novels, etc.? Good, bad, and mediocre examples. Does this give them any ideas as to what options there might be? Odds are, I'm going to have some ideas too. If I say, well, I think you should do X, that gives some added complexity. Then, you know, it makes it hard for them to say, wait a minute, I don't think that's a good idea, because it feels like that they're rejecting me if they're rejecting my idea. It feels like I'm saying, thou shalt do this, rather than just proposing an alternative. You know, there are additional emotional complexities if I present it as, this is my idea. So I don't do that. First of all, I say, would you like to hear a suggestion? Because if they say, yeah, sure, they're asking for the input, and people are more receptive of the input they ask for than if I just thrust it upon them without them asking for it. But, you know, I'll say, would you like some additional ideas? And I say, well, here's an idea I've heard about from some of the people I work with. You know, I've seen some people do it this way. And if I present it as somebody else's idea, then that clears off a bunch of the baggage. They can take it as a suggestion rather than an edict from me, particularly if it's one of several suggestions. And if it doesn't sound good to them, they could say, nah, I don't think that's a good idea, without it feeling like they're rejecting me, so it's easier for them to speak up about their point of view. And in general, you know, I'm going to want to, you know, first of all, get a bunch of options on the table, good, bad, and mediocre. Because if I try to just come up with good options, a lot of clients are going to feel like they're being railroaded and will resist that. And also, this is not the sort of thing where there's one right option that works in every situation. It generally turns out the person needs an assortment of options they can choose between depending on given situation. Now, there's some categories I'm going to try to have on the agenda. You know, talking with the person calmly and reasonably. You know, in some form I'm going to want to have, you know, in the categories. You know, taking some time to calm myself down. You know, I'm going to want to have somewhere among the possibilities. You know, getting the heck out of the situation. I'm going to want to have somewhere on the list of possibilities. You know, getting some exercise, going for a walk, meditating, doing something that calms me down, I'm going to want to have on the list. You know, expressing my feelings, you know, I'm going to want to have on the list, both expressing my feelings to the party that's aggravating me, and separately the idea of venting to some unbiased third party. And once we've got a bunch of options, we can take a look at which of these seem promising in this situation. You know, look at the advantages, disadvantages, consider what might be promising, and think about how to try it out in real life. And as part of that, I'm going to want to pay attention to the client's anticipation as to how other people will react. And does this seem realistic or not? If their anticipations as to how other people will react seem on target, then great. You know, does that suggest that we tried this out in real life, or does it suggest, no, that's a dumb idea? If the person's image of how other people are going to react seems off base, this is a good time for examining the evidence. What convinces them that, you know, their neighbor is going to go nuclear if they say, excuse me, dude, would you mind turning down your stereo? You know, and if they've got a good point, if this person does have a track record of going nuclear when people ask them to turn down the stereo, then probably asking the guy to turn down the stereo is not a good idea. On the other hand, you know, if they've never tried it, the person seems like a fairly reasonable person, there's no reason to anticipate, you know, maybe we could consider testing it out in a low-risk way. You know, and if we can come up with some plausible alternatives that the person can try out before they're too upset, this is starting to sound promising. But I also want to pay attention to, does the person have the skills necessary to pull this off? You know, and, you know, it may well be a good idea to role play some of these situations so that I can get a picture of what the client's actually thinking of saying and doing. Does this seem promising? You know, sometimes people have the necessary skills to handle the situation effectively. They just haven't registered this is a good move. Other times, and we need to work on helping them master the skills that it takes to talk calmly with the boss if the boss wants me to work on Saturday and I don't think it's my time to work on Saturday. And I think we'll have an example of this kind of approach in a few minutes. Now, I'm also going to want to pay attention to the thoughts running through the person's head. And if we've got a bunch of dysfunctional thoughts amplifying the anger, you know, we're not going to try to use rational responses to poof make the anger go away. That doesn't work very well. But if we've got the person generalizing and taking things to extremes and so on, we may well be able to tone the anger down so that it fits the situation by using rational responses. Another option that can be real useful for toning down the intensity of the anger is looking at the situation from the other person's point of view. How did it look to Charlie? Because we get more angry when what the other person's doing seems unreasonable, unjustified, etc. And sometimes the reason it looks so unreasonable and unjustified to the client is they haven't looked at it from the other person's point of view. And, you know, spending a few minutes doing that often gives them a different perspective on why the other person's doing what they're doing. How's all that sound?
Yeah. So if we have a client who whose anger is working for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would not be, so that is functional then?
Well, possibly. One thing we're going to want to pay attention to, is it actually working for them, or do they think it's working for them?
Probably they think it's working for them.
Yeah. If they think it's working for them and it isn't actually working for them, then before we, in order to get to the point where they're willing to try handling things differently, we first need to help them see how it's not actually working for them. You know, and with Carl here, you know, it sounds to me, I mean, Chris didn't actually ask these questions, but it sounds to me like at the beginning of this, he was convinced that his anger was working for him. This is the way to keep people from taking advantage of you, etc. And it sounds like he's oblivious to, this is why nobody wants to have lunch with me but this one coworker, and why, you know, people don't treat me the way I want to be treated, and people don't seem to appreciate me and recognize, you know, it's because I've pissed everybody off. You know, but it's not necessarily easy to help the person see, you know, grasp their role in the situation, because often the angry person is putting a lot of energy into blaming others. And so if I can help them see the drawbacks their current behavior has for them, you know, in what ways is it working for them? What drawbacks does it have? You know, is it a good deal? Wait a minute, if it's such a good idea, why are they in my office discussing this with me? You know, and, you know, I it's a pretty good bet that if somebody's in my office discussing something with me, it's because it's not actually turning out well for them in their life. You know, if they were actually happy with the results, they would be off in life and somebody else would be sitting in my office. But often the angry person is not registering the ways in which their current behavior is not a good idea. But another important piece of it is if we got a family situation or a workplace where maladaptive behavior is actually being reinforced by the environment, then individual therapy may not be sufficient. You know, if we got a little kid who throws tantrums, and by throwing tantrums, the parents give him what he wants, let him out of stuff, etc., I'm not going to get the kid to act in a civilized way as long as uncivilized behavior is paying off. You know, I might need to do family intervention. I might need to work with the parents on more effective discipline. You know, I'm not going to get the person to quit doing something that's actually working for them. And so sometimes, you know, it's a lot of the examples we give are from individual therapy because Barb and I happen to do mostly individual therapy, and we get a lot of referrals where individual therapy is appropriate. But it's real handy to keep in mind that individual therapy isn't always the way to go, and particularly if the environment is reinforcing maladaptive behavior, you know, we may need to work on getting some changes in the environment. In general, when it's conflict between a couple, when it's conflict between parent and child, it's probably going to make sense to do couples therapy. It's probably going to make sense to do conjoint therapy or family therapy rather than individual therapy. Yeah. If it's a little kid and the parents are being ineffective with discipline, working with the parent on more effective discipline can then work just fine. But the older the kid is, the more likely it is to turn out to be useful to involve the kid in treatment as well. Sometimes you run into a situation where it makes sense to help the client tolerate bad treatment. You know, for example, suppose the client has a job with an unfortunate boss who treats them badly, but otherwise it's a good job, they need the money, it's hard to get other jobs in their field. You know, or the client does not appreciate the way their spouse is treating them, but, you know, there are kids involved, you know, and they think it would be a better move to try to put up with the situation than to get a divorce. Now, if the client's goal is to put up with bad treatment, I'm not going to be quick to sign on to that one. You know, I go into that pretty skeptical, and we're going to need to look at it clearly, and I'm really going to need to be convinced that it actually does make sense to work to put up with bad treatment. And often it turns out that, no, it doesn't make sense, that actually it's not, you know, changing jobs makes a lot more sense. It's the client's anxiety about changing jobs makes them think that it's a bad move rather than it actually being a bad move. But sometimes it does end up making sense to try to manage to have the situation not get to me so much. And when that's the case, there's a particular approach on page 7 in the handouts. It's called stress inoculation training, or it's also sometimes called anger management training. And, you know, it makes a fair amount of sense. First of all, we need to do a good evaluation, have clear goals, and make sure that it really does make sense to try to build up the ability to tolerate this situation without it getting to me so much. And, you know, then we want to take specific situations one at a time and understand the situation, what leads up to it, the thoughts and feelings, you know, how the person currently handles it, and how they would like to be able to handle it. What would be, you know, a promising way to deal with it? How do they want their thoughts to be different? How do they want their words and actions to be different? And, you know, we may well need to teach the person some relaxation skills if they're not very good at calming themselves. And then we're going to take the situations one at a time and have them imagine the situation, imagine as realistically as possible the situation happening, and them starting to have their usual reaction, their usual thoughts, their usual emotions, their usual impulses to action. And then imagine them catching themselves, calming down, and making the desired changes in their thoughts, making the desired changes in their words and actions. Imagine it working, you know, the way we think it would work out in real life. And repeat this imaginary practice until they can imagine themselves in the situation, catching themselves, handling it the way they would like to handle it, and remaining reasonably calm while they imagine this. And then we probably would want to have them, after they've imagined coping with the situation successfully a number of times and can, after they can stay calm while imagining that, we also probably would want to have them imagine the various things that might well go wrong in real life happening and imagine them coping with that. And once the situation, once the client can handle the situation calmly in imagination, then we're ready to try it out in real life and see how this works in real life. How's that sound? Make sense? I don't do this a whole lot because it keeps turning out that most of the time it makes a lot more sense to not put up with bad treatment than to put up with bad treatment. But sometimes it does. You know, if you're in the military and you've got an obnoxious drill sergeant, you know, working out a way to put up with that probably makes a lot of sense. And this kind of package works pretty well for that. And one thing to keep in mind is in situations where the person has an image of how they would like to handle the situation, but has a hard time following through on it in the heat of the moment, imaginary practice, mental practice, is a good option. Also, using role play to practice is a good option. You know, that knowing how to do something intellectually isn't enough in a lot of situations. We need to practice it in order to be able to do it successfully. If things are moderate enough so I can go forth and practice in manageable steps in real life, hey, real life practice is ideal. But in situations where the real life situation is pretty challenging, if I imagine imagination or role play gives a way to practice under more controlled circumstances, to practice in manageable steps, start off with the easy stuff and build up to the more intense stuff. Also, often one of the challenges to putting new behaviors into play in real life is in real life, stuff happens unexpectedly. I don't know in advance when my boss is going to crab at me. And so it takes me by surprise, and it's harder to implement the new behaviors when I don't see the situation coming. If we're using imaginary practice or role play, I know it's coming. This makes it easier to try out the new behaviors. And after a number of repetitions, I've got a much better shot at putting it into practice in real life. You can think of analogies like a fire drill, learning how to dance, learning how to play an instrument, as good examples to communicate to clients the value of practicing in unnatural ways in order to get to the point where I can perform the desired behavior in real life in the heat of the moment.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So when you are training this or working your own client, and but client is living in the environment where that's happening mm-hmm. often, how do you... what kind of tips or suggestions could you give it to your client? So if the client's still practicing, you are practicing in the session mm-hmm. to become good at responding a certain way, but the client living in that environment mm-hmm. where it could come, then in between time, what kind of step the client yeah. could take?
It's going to depend on the details of the situation. You know, one option is the client could simply persist with their old behavior until they're ready to try doing things differently in real life. You know, the old behavior is not working well, or they would not be in the office discussing this with us, but it's probably been working well enough to get by for years and years. You know, like, you know, Carl could continue with his current behavior for months, you know, without it being likely that anything's going to change dramatically. And so one option is the person continues with their current behavior in real life while we work out how they would like to do things differently, work out the details, practice it in the office, and then try doing things differently in real life. And that's often a perfectly fine option. Another possibility is we may be able to find some stopgap things that they could do differently for the time being that are going to be a bit of an improvement, but not a long-term solution. You know, if their, you know, boss is a pain in the butt to deal with, you know, they could, you know, avoid the boss as much as possible for a couple of weeks while we work on stuff. You know, they could take a couple of weeks vacation and get a break from the boss while we work on stuff. You know, and, you know, what options make sense is going to vary a lot from situation to situation. If part of the problem is that the client handles their anger in inappropriate ways, you know, part of what we need to do is come up with alternatives. What would be a better option? You know, do they have an image of how they would like to do things differently? You know, let's imagine a client who, when they're angry, they throw stuff. And not only are the people around them unhappy with this, but they don't like throwing stuff either. Okay, great. When they're angry, you know, what could they do besides throw stuff? What are they hoping to accomplish by throwing the stuff? What alternatives do they see? You know, and if part of the reason they throw stuff is because they're so upset, do we need to work on toning down the intensity to make it easier for them to choose more promising alternatives? And here too, doing some brainstorming about what alternatives there might be. You know, if I'm really angry at my spouse but I don't want to hit them, some people figure that throwing something is an alternative and it's better than punching my spouse. I can buy the idea it's better than punching your spouse. Are there alternatives that would be even better than throwing stuff? You know, and sometimes in the short run you can switch from, you know, throwing expensive stuff to throwing inexpensive stuff, from throwing stuff that breaks to throwing stuff that doesn't break. You know, from throwing stuff to saying I really feel like throwing stuff. You know, and, you know, those would be sort of interim steps. That doesn't sound like an ideal long-term solution. And here too, in general, we want to help the get to the point where the person can notice their anger before it's so intense that it's hard to handle and has a range of okay alternatives that they can use instead of throwing stuff or instead of whatever dysfunctional thing they've been doing. In looking at options, it's real important to not just presume that certain options are a great idea. You know, for example, for a lot of stuff you read on anger management, presumes that assertion is the answer and that everybody should be assertive all the time and everything's going to come up roses. Now, assertion is often a good idea. You know, it's generally one of the options I'm going to have on the list and I'm going to sort of expect it to be one of the finalists. However, is assertion always a good idea? Think of the bosses you've had. Have you been so fortunate that you've only had job bosses where speaking up clearly and directly is a good idea? The odds are most of you who have had bosses where speaking up assertively is a wonderful idea and bosses where it would be a really bad idea. You know, and you know, rather than presuming that certain options are a good idea, we want, you know, I'm going to have my ideas of what's usually a good idea, but we want to pay attention to how's it actually going to work out in this particular individual's real life situation. And often people who have anger issues, you know, they ended up in the relationship with whoever they're in a relationship with while they had anger issues. You know, they're may be reasons that they're in a relationship with this person. They grew up in the family they grew up in, and that's when they develop their anger issues. You know, they may well be in a relationship where this person won't necessarily react well to assertion, or have grown up in a family where assertion is not going to go over well. And so I'm going to want to try to pay attention to what's likely to happen in real life. And also, when the person starts trying out doing things differently, we're probably going to want to have them first try it out in low-risk situations and build up to the big-time situations. If you think back to the original video of Barb doing therapy with Kathy back in the Depression term, you know, she had these fights with Rick. And, you know, she and Barb came up with the idea that maybe it would be a good idea to say, Rick, please quit calling me at work, boss notices, etc. And that made sense to Kathy intellectually, but it was a little scary. And Barb didn't have her just try it out and see what happened. You know, she helped Kathy think through, what's a low-risk, no-big-deal situation where you'd like to be able to say no? Ah, you know, what show do we watch on TV? Rick has control of the remote. You know, suppose I say, hey, Rick, could we watch Masterpiece Theater tonight? And see how that plays out. Now, that's a lot lower risk than saying no in something that's been the subject of many big-time fights in the past. And so I can try it out first in low-stakes situations. And if it turns out to be a good idea, then how do we apply it in the more high-risk situations? Now, it often turns out that being more assertive is a useful part of the package. And when behaviorists first came up with assertion training, they presumed that the reason people aren't assertive in situations where assertion makes sense is because they don't have the skills. And the old school assertion training was based on just teaching people the skills. It turns out when you collect the data and crank it through the computer, often part of the problem is the person's skills aren't up to par. But actually, if you had to pick one factor that interferes with assertion, most often it's the person's expectations about how the other party's going to respond. Sometimes it's, if I speak up for myself, they won't take me seriously. Other times, if I speak up for myself, they'll be terribly upset, or they'll get mad at me, or they'll reject me, or they'll abandon me, or... And so one of the things we wanted, when the person's not able to be assertive in situations where assertion makes sense, we're going to want to try to get a sense of, do they have the skills? You know, do they have the, what would they actually, if they were to speak up for themselves, what would they actually say in this situation? Hey, let's role play it. I'll be the boss. Hey, you've got to work on Saturday. Okay, how would you speak up and communicate that, that it's not your turn to work on Saturday? And if the person can role play it in a reasonably promising way, I know they've got the skills. If the person can't role play it in a reasonably promising way, I know we need to work on the skills here. But also, you know, how would it feel to do this in real life? What's their image of how the other person's going to react? And you know, we may need to do some quality control here. If the person is not willing to speak up with them, oh my God, if I speak up, I'll get fired. What can convince them that if they speak up, they'll get fired? Have they tried speaking up in the past? Do they have coworkers who've spoken up in reasonable ways with the boss, etc.? It may turn out that they have a boss where they're right. If they try being assertive, they'll get fired. We need to consider other alternatives. It also may well turn out that you know, when other people speak up appropriately, it works just fine. They've just been so timid they've never tried it, and we need to address their fears about being assertive rather than giving up on being assertive. A lot of therapists' image of assertion training is you give the person a copy of a self-help book and say, go forth and be assertive, or you just tell the person, you should be more assertive, and they're supposed to go forth and be assertive. And that's sort of like telling somebody, you should play the piano, and expecting them to be able to go forth and play the piano. Or giving them a book on playing the piano and expecting them to go forth and play the piano. there's a lot of options when we need to help somebody become more assertive. On page 6, we've got a breakdown stolen from Rich Rakos's book on assertion. And in addition to explaining assertion, explaining stuff is a fine thing to do and is often useful. But with complex stuff, an explanation by itself is usually not enough. A demonstration adds a lot. And it can be, I role play it and demonstrate how to do it. It can be, we watch a video. It could be, we identify a good example in real life. That's what is meant by overt and covert modeling. Bibliotherapy is fancy talk for having the person read the book about it. And there's some good self-help books on assertion. But I want to count on that by itself. Practicing either role plays in the office or practicing in imagination is real useful. And, you know, some active coaching, you know, giving the person pointers, having them try it out, giving them feedback, you know, is real valuable as part of the package. We want to identify the cognitions that get in the way of being assertive and address them in the usual ways. And then we need to think through how to help the person go put it into practice in real life in manageable steps. And for people who are either real timid about being assertive or who are facing a challenging situation, you know, we might want to practice in the office with role play or imagery and then have them practice being assertive with somebody other than the boss or spouse or whoever's the most challenging person in their life. You know, for real timid people, you can start off with things like going to your local library and ask the reference librarian to help you find something. And a lot of the timid people find that really scary to do. And wait a minute, you know, reference librarians love being useful. You know, they're not going to crab at you, well, unless you have really bad luck, they're not going to crab at you for going in and asking them to help you find something. You know, going to your local burger joint and ordering the burger the way you want with no pickles or whatever. You know, and a lot of people who are, you know, timid about being assertive find little stuff like this really scary. They've got this gut image that, you know, all hell's going to break loose if they ask for their burger with no pickles. And actually going through trying it out helps it register that this is not as big a deal as it feels like. And helps them then build up to more challenging situations. And, you know, we may well need to help them, you know, in a series of steps, build their way up to taking on some of the more challenging situations in their life. For people where part of the problem is they hold a grudge, they don't get over stuff. You know, one of the things that we're going to want to watch for is cognitions that prolong the anger, that encourage prolonged anger, and address those. For example, I worked with a number of people where their spouses had an affair, and they've chosen to stay together, but they can't get over it. And they've been year after year giving their spouse hell for having had the affair. And it can be real useful to look at the pros and cons of getting over it. You know, particularly, what would the drawbacks be? And often, it turns out there's a cognition that boils down to, you know, if I let him off the hook, he'll do it again. If I get over it, that means it was okay. You know, those sorts of cognitions. And it's completely understandable not to want your spouse to cheat on you again. So is staying mad at my spouse forever and giving him hell forever, does that sound like a promising way to get the kind of relationship I want to have with them? Or if I spend the rest of my life making them miserable, wouldn't that increase the likelihood of them running off with somebody else? You know, and part of it is helping the person register that, oh, this is not a great strategy for accomplishing what I want. And another part of it is, okay, what's a better alternative? I would prefer my spouse not to cheat on me. Playing prison guard is not a terribly promising way to go about it. You know, what do I want to do instead? And you can have come up with, you know, plausible sounding cognitions that need to stop and think, wait a minute, does this really hold water? You know, if I get over it, that means it was okay. No, stuff that's okay, I don't need to get over. I only need to get over stuff that isn't okay. You know, getting over it doesn't mean it's okay. That means I'm willing to put it behind me and make sure something better not do it again. And for a lot of people that hold grudges, they tend to sort of do a laundry list. Their reaction to a transgression is to list all the other transgressions the person's committed. Then we can get a look at what effect does that have? It has them a lot more upset. You know, if I want to be upset, then when my spouse does something inconsiderate, thinking of all the other times they've been inconsiderate is a great way to be more upset. Is that what the client wants? If they want to be more upset, great, they've got a way to do that. But aren't we discussing this because they would prefer to be less upset? Suppose I deal with transgressions one at a time rather than a laundry list. How would that work? And, you know, watching for, you know, cognitions that intensify the anger, watching for a tendency to suppress anger. And, you know, is the person letting the other party know how they feel? You know, there are a lot of people who have a hard time expressing their feelings clearly and directly, and that often is part of the problem and part of why they stay feeling however they feel. Now there too, I don't have an upfront guarantee that letting my partner know how I feel when they do X is going to turn out to be a good idea. That's something to, you know, think through with the client and come up with our best estimate as to whether it seems like a good idea. But it often turns out to be a good idea. Now it also may well be that these two need some couple therapy to work on communication rather than just me doing individual therapy. How's all this sound so far? Questions, comments, reactions?
And I would like that if you expand more on the example of trust that you mentioned. And what kind of other alternatives? I had a case, that's why when you were talking I was just writing.
Well, why don't you just say a little bit about the case and that might give me a clearer way to explain it.
I just had an assessment one session, so in general, and her complaint is that she it's hard for her to get over that her husband was communicating and chatting. She found by accident she found out that one time, twice, and for him it was okay since he's not physically involved and doesn't see the people, but she was really mad and upset that it's not okay because they just got married. How can he still have other relationships going on? And she went to the family, told everybody, that everybody made him feel bad. Then he found out, yeah, I don't want people to look at me that way. I think I'm wrong. I'm not going to do this anymore. But she's still doubting, and she's really mad at herself, how she has to go check her phone, his phone all the time. And she's not happy that she has that urge to do that consistently. And she cannot trust. That's why she came to therapy.
And so two different interventions come to mind. One is, you know, when she goes to check the phone, you know, take the situation, what leads up to it, thoughts and feelings, and pay attention to what is she hoping to accomplish by checking the phone. And we've got a couple different possibilities. You know, one possibility is that she's hoping to catch him being bad and punish him as a strategy for getting him to not do this. You know, another possibility is that she's afraid he's chatty and she's hoping to reassure herself by checking and discovering that he's not breaking the rules.
One more time, the last one.
You know, she may be trying to, you know, deal with her own anxiety by checking in the hopes that she'll discover that it's all okay. You know. And there are a lot of people with different problems to get into. It's usually discussed in terms of reassurance seeking. You know, oh my God, I'm afraid I've got cancer. I'll go see my doctor. He'll check it out and say, no, it's fine, and then I'll feel better. That sounds completely reasonable. And, you know, for some people, hey, I've got a concern, I get it checked. You know, the doctor says it's okay. That may well work for me. But there are a lot of people where their anxiety is more persistent. They go, you know, see the doctor, get checked. He says it's okay. They feel better for a little while. Then their anxiety builds back up, and they go check again. And so it can end up, you know, with repetitive checking and be problematic that way. Or I'm concerned, I go in to see my doctor, and he says, oh, that doesn't look so good. We better get a biopsy. Oh, my, this, the results are equivocal. I better see you in 6 months. That, you know, checking stuff in the hopes of being reassured doesn't necessarily result in, you know, the what I'm hoping for. And there are a lot of people with anxiety-related problems where the more they check on stuff, the more it stirs up anxiety. A good example is all the people who are concerned about a spot on their hand or whatever, so they research it on the web. And they see all these pictures of terrible stuff and all these horror stories, and the more they research it, the more scared they are. And, you know, so, circling back to your, so what's she hoping to accomplish by checking on him, you know? And, you know, is this a good plan? If I check the phone in the hopes of feeling better, does it result in me feeling better, or does it result in me feeling worse? Does checking once settle the issue, or do I find myself having to check a second time and a third time? And it may well be that one of the things we need to explore is how to deal with uncertainty, how to deal with not knowing for sure. You know, because if I attempt to escape uncertainty by, you know, checking everything in the hopes of eliminating all uncertainty, that ends up being counterproductive in a variety of ways. And at some point, I need to, you know, tolerate not knowing for sure. I mean, if you think about it, if we're talking about trust, if I know for sure, then this is not a matter of trust. This is a matter of knowing. Hmm. You know, trust is when I take the person's word for it, even though I don't have an upfront guarantee. And particularly if somebody's trust has been violated in the past.
That's what was their
case. Yeah, there's often some real ambivalent, hey, you know, I trusted this person once, and it turned out to be a bad idea. And one question is, do I want to risk trusting them again or not? And it can be real useful to look at the pros and cons of trusting them again. And, you know, helping them think through, you know, if I trust them, I might be betrayed again. I might be hurt again. On the other hand, if I don't trust them, you know, being in a relationship with somebody I don't trust does not sound like a whole lot of fun. You know, it seems like, you know, it may make it hard to feel close, it would make it hard to feel intimate. You know, I spend a lot of time and energy worrying, etc. And helping the person think through the pros and cons of taking the risk of trusting the person again can be really useful. And the details are going to vary based on the situation. It sounds like part of what happened in this situation is they came into the relationship with different ideas about what's okay and what's not okay, and they hadn't talked that over and reached an agreement. You know,
she was still stuck.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't trust. Like,
yeah. Well, and one thing that might be useful for her to pay attention to is what's her husband's track record in terms of following through on stuff they've agreed on. You know, that if I have something I expect the other person to do, but I haven't told them that, I haven't asked them that, they don't know that's what I expect of them, then if they don't do it, they're not betraying my trust, they haven't gotten the memo. Yeah. Let's suppose my image is when you get married, you quit hanging out with your friends and you only hang out with your spouse. I've had a number of clients who had that image. And their partner, they've never discussed it. Their partner doesn't realize that it's the image they got. Now, it would be a much better idea to discuss this before you get married rather than running into it after you get married. But helping the client think it through and register, if he doesn't know this is what I expect and he doesn't do it, that's a different thing than if he agrees to something and then chooses not to follow through on it. Another part of it is looking at, does she have reason to believe that it makes sense to trust him from here on out? You know, is there reason to believe that he is indeed going to break off his texting relationship with this person and not resume it? And this is not simple stuff to sort out. For a lot of people, it's a question of, how do I figure out who to trust and who not to trust? You know, if somebody's betrayed my trust once, does it make sense to just cut them off and never trust them again? Or does it sometimes make sense to give them a second chance? And, you know, what's a doable way of doing that? I often use an example like, you know, suppose I have an employee who I catch stealing money out of petty cash. And I choose not to fire them. They repent. They say they won't do it again. Does it make sense for me to give them the key to petty cash? Well, maybe, maybe not. One part of it is, you know, how do I figure out what to trust them with and what not to trust them with? You know, one completely reasonable option is to decide, you stole from me once, you're out of a job, I'm going to hire somebody else. It also might be completely reasonable for me to choose to give them a second chance. I'm probably not going to want to give them free access to the entire checking account. You know, I'm going to need to think through how, you know, and if I don't give them any scope, then I don't have a chance to discover whether they can be trustworthy or not. If I give them free rein, I'm taking a big risk. And something in between the two extremes might make sense. You know, depending on how much money we have in petty cash, I might give them access to petty cash and check it each night at first. And there's a limit to how much money they can make off with them. You know, and if the petty cash keeps balancing daily, then maybe I'll taper off to checking on it weekly and checking on it monthly. It also seems like it would be not real clever for me to give an employee access to petty cash and never check on how things are doing. And, you know, collaboratively thinking through some of these situations get very complex. How's all that sound?
Thank you.
And one of the things that's hard for a lot of clients is accepting that if I'm going to be in a relationship with somebody, I don't know for sure that they'll never betray me. I don't know for sure that everything's going to turn out fine. You know, even if the reality is this person's going to be completely faithful, no transgressions ever, I don't know that up front. You know, and I won't know that until I'm on my deathbed and in a position to look back. And even then, all I know is that I didn't catch them being unfaithful. One of the things about reality is if we catch somebody being bad, we know they were bad. If we don't catch them being bad, we don't know if they were good or if we just didn't catch them. And it's not good that it's that way, but that's the way reality works. One of the issues that comes up in dealing with anger and conflict is, you know, we've got the angry person like Carl, and we've also got the timid people who have a hard time speaking up for themselves and dealing with anger and conflict in appropriate ways. And let's go back to the video now. We've got another video of Christine Podesky. This was with a more anxious, timid person. Scenario here, this person has just recently been promoted to a management position. And she's now in the position of supervising two people who a month ago were colleagues, and now they're her subordinates. And they squabble with each other all the time. And for reasons of her history, she's really uncomfortable with anger and conflict. And she's really uncomfortable with putting her foot down and saying, you idiots need to quit fighting with each other and do your jobs. And so Chris is working with her. At this point, Chris has found out about the situation and thoughts and feelings and so on. And they've identified that, you know, the client needs to figure out how to deal with this effectively. But up to this point in her life, she's just avoided conflict. And she is having a hard time thinking, what would she actually say and do if these two start squabbling in her office? So Chris is trying to help her think that through and come up with some good options.
Anyone else in your life that you know who you think is really good at handling that kind of situation? Yeah, I have a friend who's pretty good. What's your friend's name? Well, I'm thinking of two different people, but there is one person that I'm thinking of. She's a real estate agent. And she's told me that often she gets clients that get into fights when she's showing them around houses.
People actually get into fights when she's showing them around houses?
Okay.
And has she told you what she does when people do that?
Well, she does different things. Sometimes she'll just leave the room herself. Sometimes she'll suggest that they need to calm down and talk about it without yelling.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes she'll just distract them, you know, take them to see something else.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you think she decides which of those things to do? Comfortable to almost always leave the room that people are arguing. But I wonder under what circumstances your friend might stay in the room. Why do you think she might sometimes stay and tell people to calm down? Or
maybe if she thought she could distract them or mm-hmm. something.
So she thought that she could be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It might also, I wonder if it depends on how they're important customers or something and she needs to stay there and try to get them to work it out to make the sale.
Probably.
She might have motivation then to do it because it might be important for her.
Okay.
It would be an interesting thing you could talk to her about and find out because it sounds like she's got some important information that might be helpful to you.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation with Rick and Arnold, do you think it would be to your advantage if you knew what to do to stay in the room if they start shouting? Actually help settle things down. Would that be a good thing for you
probably,
in your job?
Probably. I think it's probably what I should do.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, you said a couple things that your friend would do. You said that sometimes she'll just say to people, you need to settle down.
Right.
Is that, what effect do you think that would have if you said that to Rick and Arnold?
Well, I am their boss now.
That would be one response. That's a possibility of a response you could do.
To tell them to settle down.
Tell them to settle down.
Uh-huh.
That's one option. We need to come up with several options.
Okay.
But that's one option. And then the outcome of that is they might settle down or they might not.
Right.
If they do settle down, then you get problem solved. Then you go on to the next problem. Okay. What's something else your friend does? You said one of the things that she does.
Like distracts them.
She distracts them. How does she do that?
She just takes them to somewhere else. She'll say, you know, let me forgot to show you this, or let me take you and show you something else. What about this feature over here that I...
Could you think of any way you might do that with Rick and Arnold?
If they yell at each other? It's hard for me to even get out of just being completely paralyzed when they start yelling at each other.
How about your friend if she was in the office with them? Do you think she would be able to think of something to do to distract them?
Probably.
What do you think she might do?
I think she's very upset. She might ask them if they thought about it from a different perspective or something like that. Or she might, I don't know. I'm sure she could come up with something then.
Let's say more about this. What do you mean, have they thought about it from a different perspective? What might that mean?
One thing to notice, just in terms of the pacing, Chris is allowing time for her to stop and think and be puzzled and mull it over. You know, if we zip too fast, it doesn't give the client time to think things through. You know, and rushing does not necessarily get you there faster. You know, that one important chunk of doing guided discovery effectively is allowing enough time for the client to think things through and consider possibilities and come up with ideas and not just handing them answers right away. Now, another thing that I would be inclined to do but Chris hasn't done is if once they start yelling at each other, it's hard for her to deal with it. Suppose I noticed tension building before they start yelling at each other and said, dude, you need to calm down before they started yelling. That would be easier for the client to do, and it would probably be a more productive meeting, and it probably would result in these guys not yelling at each other so much.
And, you know, one of the things that Rick and Arnold are doing is they're writing this joint manual.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of having trouble with how to structure who writes what piece of it and how to get it to fit together. And so, you know, maybe there's a way they could separate it out differently, or, you know, who's responsible for what piece.
So if you threw this question out to them, that maybe instead of just fighting about it, the three of you could look at the different options,
right.
Do you think there's a chance that might settle them down a little bit?
Maybe.
Because it would distract them in a way from what they're immediately fighting about and get them to think about something different.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting idea. Had you thought about that even before you came here today?
No, I think so.
That just came into your mind just now.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got, by thinking about Sarah and what you know about what she does, you've come up with two ideas that you could try with Rick and Arnold. One is to tell them to settle down.
Right.
The other would be to distract them in a way by asking them if they've thought about things from a different perspective and trying to shift the discussion.
Right.
Now, what do you think about each of those two ideas? Do you think either or both of those might be helpful?
Maybe. I mean, I really want to just get out of there if they started yelling at each other.
Sure you would.
I mean, it almost seems like it would be that maybe I could tell them that I can't have a meeting if they don't know each other. You know, that's like an end. I really could maybe have a meeting.
So that might, and could you mix that with telling them to settle down? Like saying settle down?
Yeah.
Would you say that I can't have a meeting, or what would be a good thing for you as a supervisor to say to them? How would be a good way for you to say this? It sounds like ideally you'd like to come across how?
More confident than I feel.
More confident than you feel. So what would be a confident way? If you were feeling more confident, what would be the way you might say that to them?
Maybe we can't continue this meeting if we don't settle down.
Okay. I'm going to write that down for you.
Okay.
We'll give you the sheet of paper when you leave today. So we can't continue this meeting if you don't settle down.
Right.
And then if they might have lingering fighting even after you say that, because sometimes people can't stop immediately. So what could you say further if that seems to be helping some?
Other than anything, maybe.
What is it anyway?
Well, I could remind them to settle down more.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could do the other thing you wrote down.
Okay, so you could repeat again, settle down.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you told them to settle down again, what could you do then?
Well, I could do the other thing you wrote down about asking them if they could think about it from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've actually got three steps you could take in a meeting if they do start arguing. And I'm wondering, from your perspective as a manager, I know it would be a lot more comfortable to just run out of the room. Would there be any advantages to you if you could get yourself to stay in the room and go through these steps? Tell them we can't continue this meeting if you don't settle down. Reminding them to settle down and then asking them to look at it from a different perspective. If you were able to stay in the meeting and try those strategies out.
Well, absolutely would be an advantage to me.
What would the advantage be to you?
Well, for a start, they might see me as more competent. I mean, I think people kind of know that I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a huge advantage for me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I did manage to stay, if they quieted down, if that actually worked, then I wouldn't have to deal with all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't lose my job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how about, you mentioned other people would see you as more confident. Would you also see yourself as more confident?
Well, in that particular situation, I suppose I would.
Because mm-hmm. if you run out of the room, how will you see yourself?
As a failure.
So there's a lot of advantages if we can work on this in terms of coming up with strategies to cope with these things that might happen. There'd be a lot of advantages to you instead of just leaving the room when they happen. So maybe what we should do.
Also, notice her expression, her posture, and so on. She's sounding more competent to me now than she was 3 minutes ago. Questions, comments, reactions so far?
It seemed like when she was asking her, what would you do, she just froze.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as she said, what would Sarah do,
mm-hmm.
she was able to come up with just one thing.
And that's often a real useful line of intervention. If the client can think of somebody they know who can handle this sort of situation well, they may already know some good options and can think about how they could put that into practice. Or it may be they haven't discussed this with their friend, and a homework assignment would be to go home and find out how Sarah would handle this.
I'm just wondering, both of the examples you use, both are in work environment.
Mm-hmm.
In a family environment, there are a lot of dynamics going
mm-hmm.
on. And I wonder how that plane of family environment, because there are like multiple dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a level of there are some members in the family who has more influence or power.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that? I'm thinking it's so much more difficult.
Well, it's more complex, so it probably would take some more time and thought and working things through step by step to figure out what might be good alternatives. You know, on the other hand, we also have more players involved, and maybe some of them are good examples. You know, I'm, you know, thinking of a situation or two where, you know, the client is having a hard time figuring out how to deal with her husband, and the husband's mom is real effective in dealing with him. Oh, does that give any ideas as to what might be worth trying? Now, also, family situations can be really complex. And remember, if we're dealing with family issues, individual therapy isn't necessarily the ideal way to do that. You know, and so one consideration is, should I be doing family or couple intervention rather than individual therapy? Or, you know, does it make sense for me to keep doing individual therapy with my client and get the couple or family into family therapy, couple therapy as well?
I'm thinking of a blended family issue that came up. The kind of mine who, you know, it doesn't live with the extended family, but there's a union and things.
Mm-hmm.
And when, so there is kind of like a bullying
mm-hmm.
Family member who is bullied, and how, and it becomes any time client is pretty assertive,
mm-hmm.
every time she wants to assert herself, the family member who is a bully has also higher, kind of in the family dynamics, has more kind
mm-hmm.
of power, and uses that
mm-hmm.
use that to his advantage
mm-hmm.
to kind of.
And so one can think in terms of what options do we have here.
Okay.
And one option that people sometimes overlook is, before we go to this family gathering, do I want to touch base with some of the other people in you know, one-on-one, and coordinate with some other people about how to handle this situation. I just, the last week, had a session with a client who's first-generation Indian-American, who's going to a family gathering, and one of the many issues is, traditionally, everybody goes in Indian garb, and then her aunts criticize how she's dressed and try to make her feel bad about her weight and so on, and she doesn't have a weight issue at all. And one of the things she's done is she's coordinated with her cousins, and none of them are wearing Indian garb, so there. And having some reinforcements, having some other members of the family who agree that, no, playing along with this is not a good move, is real useful. You know, often part of it is thinking through, wait a minute, do I need to bend over backwards to please this person? Or does it make sense to put up with them disapproving of the way I'm dressed? You know, do I need to take this person's opinion so seriously? And it's going to vary from person to person and family to family and culture to culture. Some, in some families, in some cultures, what my aunts think of me is really important. And in some, it's not that big a deal after all. You know, and often people are in the habit of relating to certain individuals certain ways because when they were a little kid, this is how they related to their aunt. And they haven't processed, wait a minute, I'm not a little kid anymore. I don't need to maintain the same relationship. You know, now, you get added levels of complexity, you know, when, you know, you've got cultural shifts. You know, my client is pretty wholeheartedly acculturated to American culture. You know, she grew up here from early elementary age on. She went to University of Chicago and has advanced degrees and so on. And her aunts actually came over later than she did and are not nearly as acculturated. And so there's, and then there's the whole family back in India
who thinks everybody's gone to hell in a handbasket by being so Americanized. And so we've got all those issues to sort out how to deal with.
Interestingly, yeah, the family I'm not member is the same, comes from the same background. And usually Asian culture, I think this is a common thing. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there is like a, you know, certain member of the family has some power, mm-hmm. being older. And there's a history of mm-hmm. abuse as well.
Yeah. And in Indian culture, or at least some corners of Indian culture, seniority is taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. And the presumption is the older people deserve respect and the younger people don't deserve respect, etc. But also, India is a big and diverse culture, and there's not the, you know, it's easy to start thinking of a different culture as a monolith. I know one of the things that impressed my daughter in high school, she had a number of Indian friends, and she was amazed to discover that they grew up with different languages. Yes, India has 80 million different languages. And, you know, culture, you know, get a lot of variations within places that we look at as being all the same culture. No, it's just like if you're looking at the U.S. from the outside, you know, what's the difference between the Midwest and the South and the Northeast and the West? Actually, there are lots of differences. You know, it's not a monolith. And the same applies to most cultures, unless you're talking about a very small and tight, you know, location. Other questions, comments, reactions? You know, in this situation, you know, there are also some options that the two of them didn't think of is, wait a minute, these guys are arguing over who writes which chapter. She's the boss. You know, one option is for her to assign chapters, and then they don't have to fight about it. They could be upset with her or not, but she's the boss. She doesn't have to worry about whether they like her choices. You know, and I really like the idea of trying to intervene before it reaches the yelling level, which it sounds like the client hasn't even thought of. A lot of people who dislike conflict try to wait as long as possible before intervening without registering that if I wait till things are really tense, it's harder to intervene there. It's scarier for me to intervene there, and it's more likely to go badly if I can address the issues before anybody's terribly upset. That greatly improves the odds of getting people to be calm and reasonable and civilized. You know, and another part of it is, wait a minute, I'm the boss here. You know, there could be consequences if these yahoos are too much of a pain in the butt. And I think one of the issues going on here is this person isn't yet comfortable in the boss role and hasn't registered that, oh, it's okay for me to exercise some of the power I now have. Skipping ahead quickly to page 9 in the handout, clients aren't the only people who get angry. Therapists sometimes get angry at clients. And just as a quickie, we've got an example of using a thought sheet for a therapist to handle their own emotions. In this case, this is, I think the therapist here was actually involved in an outcome study of CBT for cocaine abuse. And the client is being verbally abusive towards him, and he's feeling angry as well as some fear. And, you know, I don't need this garbage. I don't deserve it. Find yourself another therapist. You're on your own, buddy. You know, he's a goddamn liar, etc. He doesn't want help. And those are obviously thoughts and feelings that are going to get in the way of being an effective therapist if I don't, you know, recognize them and get perspective on them and figure out how to deal with them. And here you can see how this particular therapist chose to deal with it, and it worked pretty well. And, you know, remember that, you know, I need to be in touch enough with my own emotions so that I can manage them so they don't muck things up. And that can include, you know, getting angry at the client for being the way they are. You know, it gets in the way of being an effective therapist. And it can also include getting in, letting myself get intimidated by the client's anger.
which also can really get in the way of being effective therapists. And if you want to get into this in more detail, we've got a whole bunch of recommended readings on page 10 in the handouts. There are a bunch of good self-help books on assertion that Alberti and Emmons has been around since Rocks Were Soft and is a pretty good one. And we've got Beck's book on anger, which is more sort of conceptual, abstract, world conflict level than individual therapy level. So we've got some interesting, useful points in it, and a variety of other pretty good books. Linehan's Skills Training Manual for Borderline Personality Disorder has a number of exercises and so on in it that are useful, lots of people who aren't borderline as well as borderlines. Borderlines do typically have some really little major anger issues that benefit from some work. Yes?
You didn't talk about group anger management group at all. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about group therapy for anger.
I mean, basically, pretty much everything I've talked about can be done in a group setting or individual setting. Groups got, advantages in terms of being able to treat multiple people at once. But also, often people, are able better at seeing things clearly when they're looking at somebody else's issues than at their own. And then they can think in terms of how to apply it in their own lives. If you've got multiple people in the room, this gives opportunities for doing role plays and so on, where the therapist doesn't have to participate, so I can sit and observe. And, participating and observing simultaneously is more challenging than if we can get two people role playing and I can observe and the rest of the group can observe and discuss. One of the choices is we can do sort of a psychoeducational group with a planned curriculum, and it's not very individualized, and that can be useful, but it's less tailored to the needs of the individual. Or we can do a group where we take the time to, for each person, take some specific situations and walk through the situation, what led up to it, thoughts and feelings and so on. Either one can work well. The ones doing a group where we're individualizing it is more challenging for the therapist. And also, in groups in general, there are some advantages to having a co-therapist, particularly if we're doing a lot of interacting, if we're doing a lot of individualizing, if we're using the group dynamics, then having a co-therapist makes that much easier to do because, you've got added levels of complexity and it gets mind-boggling. If you want references on the, anger management in groups, just write me a note and I can track some good ones down. And that's it for tonight. You get to actually get some sleep, and I'll see you bright and early in the morning.